A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Alicia Fletcher and our very own supervising producer and podcaster, Emily Gagne. The Naughty Girls of the Naughties. That's what I wanted to title this final episode of the series, but decided to keep it tight. Although the femme fatale archetype could be seen as a warning to men, it can also be used for strong feminist storytelling and a whole lot of fun. Now, Alicia, when did we start seeing femme fatales in movies, and how have they evolved up until the early 2000s?
I mean, they're there from the very beginning. They kind of evolved from what in the silent era was termed as the vamp. If you think about like Theda Bara, and just this idea of even some roles that Gloria Swanson played in the silent era, they've always been with us. They've been with us in literature. They're just called something else. They're very, like, almost born out of burlesque, I would say, as a, like, performing art tradition. But you really see them kind of in the late silent era. And if I had to name one director, it would be Joseph von Sternberg in his silent period with a film like Underworld, which stars Evelyn Brandt as the best name for a femme fatale, Feathers McCoy. And she's a femme fatale, but she's also not. And then he goes, you know, full blown with the Dietrich films. And then, you know, it kind of gets absorbed into the crime genre. And that's where you see someone like Fritz Lang, who, of course, was using femme fatales in his silent films. You know, Maria, Robot Maria from Metropolis is the ultimate femme fatale. Something like Woman in the Window, you know, Ministry of Fear. I mean, Lang really was the king of the femme fatale. And if there's one actress who picks up that torch and has worked with Lang in the past, it's Barbara Stanwyck. And so it's very fitting that we're talking about a film today that opens with our femme fatale watching Double Indemnity, not just watching Double Indemnity, which is Stanwyck's, you know, most iconic femme fatale, but the scene where she blows someone away with a gun, not once but twice, is, you know, very, very telling. Like, the femme fatale is complicated and comes out of kind of the war years and the concerns around unrestrained femininity as applied to, you know, to sexuality. It's got so many different avenues, but it's been with us from day one. Like, I mean, I think the ultimate femme fatale for me, I have a tattoo of her, and it's Musa Dora from Irma Vep. Like, that is 1915, 1916, a really famous serial by Louis Fallaud. That is the, like, origin story of the femme fatale.
This whole series, we've been looking at the Hays Code and its effect on film and also on how we've seen people. It's how, especially with queer communities, and that you don't start seeing people come into their own until the 60s. I feel like women kind of got shunted to the same way, is that any women behaving badly had to be punished because they were usually in the crime genre. So there then becomes this backlash of step out of line, like join, become a mall, do whatever. You know, I mean, every Joan Crawford movie is kind of like this, and you're going to be punished. And I feel like that's very Hays Code reactionary, but it's also how we get all of our coolest women characters up until that point. Like, no one is looking at Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm and being like, that is what I want to be. You know what I mean?
As a silent film person, I can tell you that for some reason, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm does have rabid fans. There's like a small little contingent. I'm not a big fan. I'm actually unpatriotically not into Mary Bickford, but you'd be amazed at some of the travels I've had and the Pickfordites and the Rebeccas of Sunnybrook Farm.
Pickfordites.
They're like, it's like, it translates into like Anne of Green Gables eventually, right? Like, it's just, yeah. But you're right to point out that is the opposite archetype for sure.
I just wonder if with these, like, can we call them Pickford heads? Like pick heads? Would that be it?
Yeah.
Do they like show up at screenings with like curls and like all ready to go? It feels like there's like a whole costume that would go along with this.
Yeah, there's a lot of like Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a very different podcast. We are going to talk about kink very shortly, but, and that might be what explains this subset, but let's not get too far down that rabbit hole.
Well, Emily, you are someone who very often programs films that are by women, featuring women, things like that. For films that are not necessarily film noir, what are some movies that you've kind of programmed or you've seen where this archetype will enter into it, even though it's not necessarily a crime film?
That's an interesting question. I mean, like, these days there is the whole, like, unlikable female character, which is such a thing that's like, she's not a villain, but she is a villain. Are we allowed to like her? Or, like, are we allowed to support her? Like, people are crazy for, you know, Gone Girl, for example. Like, they think of that character as, like, they almost idealize her. They like mention the dates in her diary like every year. They commemorate
my father's wife at the dinner table one year, like, had to walk me through why that film is perfect. She's like, you don't understand why this woman is doing what she's doing. And there was a compare and contrast with the book, and I was like, all right,
I mean,
all
we've
right,
all thought about Pike. Doing what she did. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And I mean, that is a great film, too. And the book is great, too. But, like, a lot of times with my programming, like, people will be like, I just didn't like that character, so I didn't like the film. Like, Take This Waltz, which I know is a film that, Becky, you also love. Like,
love it.
That's not a femme fatale, but it's a complicated female character that does, like, bad things in the more, like, regular person sense, and people can't take that. So, but if she does it in, like, a sexy way, if she's a villainess, maybe we accept it. But, like, the real deal crimes of, like, personal crimes, people are not okay with.
And tying this into an earlier episode from season 4 about Psycho Bitties, which is one of my favorite episodes, but for some reason, people just haven't connected with it. I love it.
Worst performing episode.
I know, but it's so good. But I do genuinely feel like the femme fatale is the logical progression of the Psycho Bitty is the logical progression of the femme fatale.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, definitely with the Bette Davis, Joan Crawford, Psycho Bitties.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at the future ones, like Olivia de Havilland and Shelley Winters and Debbie Reynolds, like, they never played in their heyday. They never played the femme fatale, and they never played sexy, to be perfectly honest. So it is interesting where that goes. But I definitely see what you're saying with, like, Baby Jane and Dead Ringer, and that's definitely working with their careers in a way that is fascinatingly regressive.
Yeah, even Straight Jacket to a certain extent has a bit of that element. All right, well, let's get into our first film, which is actually called Femme Fatale. So in watching a Brian De Palma movie, there are a few themes you're going to expect. Graphic sex and nudity, check. Doppelgangers and mistaken identities, what can you say? The man loves vertigo. Voyeurism, he likes Rear Window too. Controversial feminist heroes like Carrie, a double cross, see Carlito's Way, and of course, complicated gay characters. Please see Dress to Kill A All. A movie that checks a bunch of those boxes is Femme Fatale. It bombed at the box office, but is being reappraised as a modern camp masterpiece and an example of some of De Palma's finest work. Now, Alicia, you are someone who has seen many, many De Palma movies. You have watched this movie about 3 times, you said. Is this something that should be reappraised? Should this be in the De Palma canon up to next to Carrie or Scarface or one of the other hundreds of thousands, Untouchables? Let's just go down the De Palma list, shall we?
Carrie, no, because Carrie is a vanguard, perfect movie. Scarface, perhaps, because Scarface is out of control, unrestrained trash that I love, but not a good movie. This one is so weird. And, you know, I've seen it a lot this year, not because I'm obsessed with this movie. It just keeps coming up because I think when a film turns 20, it just kind of gets these, like, reappraisals. And that happened last year in 2022. So this is just cuckoo bananas, unrestrained De Palma, you know, and there's always going to be reviews and naysayers who say it's, like, unrestrained excess and too much style. And I don't agree or subscribe to that because that's always been De Palma. Yeah, I don't know what this film is. He knows what he's doing. It knows what it is. It's just taking us 20 years, and we'll probably take an extra 8 years on top of that for anyone to really figure it out.
I think it's also the fact that it's very much trying to launch a new star who didn't really rise to the heights I think everybody expected her to. So it doesn't have that sort of cachet of like, oh, it's one of Rebecca Romijn's first roles, because we just don't really think of her in that way anymore. She has a fine career. I'm not worried about Rebecca Romijn. But I just think had she become the icon that everybody kind of expected her to be, this film would have had a higher profile.
I think she's an icon. Do not get me wrong. And also she's...
Well, she's a supermodel. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But like prior to this, if you think about X-Men, like she's Mystique. And that's actually a very amazing performance, I think, and very physical. And she's obviously a performer that was utilized for her body more than her acting skill. But I think that she's quite good in this. And it's important to know that she's playing... I was reading the Roger Ebert review, and he says she plays four roles, and I can only count two, so I'm not even sure I understand this film. But then I kind of get what they're saying is, like, each role is a double role, but she has a lot of accents that she has to perform. Yeah. She has a lot of bad wigs. It is an incredibly physical performance. I think she gives it her all, and if we're talking about De Palma and De Palma femme fatales, you know, you have, like, Melanie Griffith and many, many others. They all kind of have a similar, like, acting as though they're in a different era vibe that I think he directs his femme fatales with. And, or Nancy Allen, who's less femme fatale and more heroine. I think that's just what he does. I don't think, you know, she also did Rollerball this year, which is a very, very bad remake. But the early 2000s was just trash for film, like, for a few years.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think it's interesting that she's sort of like become a comedic actress over time. And
I love her.
Yeah. Like she was on Ugly Betty and she's done lots of other things. And now she's married to Jerry O'Connell. And I just feel like she needed more laughs in her life. And when I watch this, I think about that a little bit. And you know what? She's kind of funny in this film. This film definitely is campy. And there's moments that are funny. And I think it's because she kind of plays up that campiness.
You know who's really camp in this is Antonio Banderas.
He is having the time of his life.
Oh my gosh.
He's going full Almodovar. Yeah. Like, and I know he got this because he wasn't he was a star, but not like a huge, huge star yet. You know, as he was married to Melanie and she was like, yeah, I do this De Palma film. It's a fun time.
He was also at a point where he, from what I was reading, they were saying that he thought this part initially was too small for him. Because at this point, he was becoming the star. And he's very much also very much a secondary male character, which you don't, especially early 2000s, for our action stars, which he was becoming, you don't see very often.
Yeah, I mean, he works really well. This is a very European film. You know, one of the first films to be entirely shot in Europe out of Hollywood. Like a Hollywood film that was entirely shot in Europe is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, he fits, though, really well. We haven't even said what the film is about. I don't even know if it matters. That's what's so funny. There's, like, dream sequences, flashbacks.
Triple crosses at certain points. You don't know who's going after who. There's various bad guys.
Mistaken identity.
I mean...
Yeah, ambassadors, kidnapping.
Hitchcock is all over
it. It opens at the Cannes Film Festival, which is, like, the most important thing to note. Like, it's one of the greatest opening sequences, I think, of any film, is this long sequence... which is scored by Ryuichi Sakamoto, who we recently lost and is, like, top of his game in this. And it was filmed really on the closing day of the 2001, maybe 2000, Cannes Film Festival. So all of the paparazzi and some of the red carpet people are real Cannes attendees. Sandrine Bonnaire, who's one of my favorite actresses, has this, like, cameo in it. It's so funny in this fake movie that looks like such a joke. Of, like, the kind of crap that Cannes sometimes has to show. It is the hottest sequence that takes place in a women's restroom between Rebecca Romijn and Rie Rasmussen, who the Danish, I think she's Danish, actress, model, director, also Victoria's Secret model like Rebecca Romijn, wearing, you know, I forgot to look this up. I feel like it looks like Schiaparelli designed that breast piece that's basically snakes covered in diamonds. It is... unbelievably beautiful and horrifying and kind of
it
has elements
of...
It
doesn't look comfortable. It looks like beauty is pain is what it looks like.
And the idea is that Rebecca Romijn is going to steal the diamonds and switch, like with a bait and switch. She's seducing this woman and it's hot, super hot. I'm probably not getting through just how hot it is, but And then she double crosses her crime boss, and then they go to jail. And then they 7 years later, it flashes forward, and they track her down to kill her when she's already like taken someone else's identity, who's just lost their husband,
who
and
daughter, is identical to her. It's her doppelganger.
Yeah, and then flies to the U.S. and becomes an ambassador's wife. And then Antonio Banderas is a paparazzi guy, and he takes a photo of her, which is a problem because she's in hiding. And then the crime bosses get out of jail, and then they find out that this person has, you know, this woman, they're lore that they're trying to like come after for double-crossing them is this ambassador's wife, and then it goes from there.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Oh, and then by the way, spoiler alert, it was all a dream, but yet a prophetic dream, and so everything that she saw happens, and she goes and she changes the future, and it's, there's a lot happening here.
That, to me, is less Hitchcock and more specifically Lang and the film Woman in the Window, 1944. Yeah, you know, De Palma is just one of those directors that we all know really loves the heavy hitters of the classical era. And all of his films have tons of references to them. I mean, the score is so beautiful. And it's Pino Donaggio, who'd worked with De Palma all the time. But he's really getting into his, like, Bernard Herrmann phase with this film. Almost to the point where you think they, like, dug up Bernard Herrmann and, like, put him in front of a, you know, it's so over the top, and I really admire it, but I don't like it, if that makes sense. Like, I always give this 4 stars, and I want people to see it. And I love seeing it in theaters, but I'm not quite there yet with it. I need it to simmer a bit longer.
I think you're right. It needs to be seen with a bunch of other people, and I think it's one of those movies that consistently you're like, I'm sorry, what? I kept having to go back to go like, I'm sorry, what just happened? Okay, what is she doing now? Because what I do think they do a really good job of this is making her so enigmatic that you don't know what's going to happen next. Like, you're never more than one step ahead of her, where I think a lot of heist movies that aren't very good or double cross movies, you're like, oh, I see exactly what she's doing, right? This one, I'm like, I don't actually know where this is going. I know she's trying to manipulate Antonio Banderas. I know she's trying to do this, but I don't know to exactly what end, and I don't know what's going to happen. And then I didn't know what was going to happen. I did not see the dream sequence twist coming.
No.
Even though it's like a typical twist of movies for it to be a dream. And you're like, you know what? Once you find out it's a dream, you're like, okay, this is all making sense to me. This is all tracking as to why none of this quite works. Because it's a dream. Like when she jumps. Also, that shot when she like jumps into the water and stunning. Then she's like nude.
It's like insane. Oh, yeah, it's very beautiful.
It's the only scene gorgeous. There anyone is like fully nude. Like, this is weird, also weird for De Palma, because De Palma loves women's bodies. And this is something we'll talk about in a moment, that he's often been accused of being deeply misogynistic and chopping women up and things like this. And this is kind of intended to be his response to that. But that is the only scene in which any woman is seen completely nude within the film. All the other times they're in underwear. And it's beautiful, and it's very artistic as opposed to being voyeuristic, which is wild.
It's also interesting that Rebecca Romijn, like, I was reading that she actually, like, really struggled with the sort of, like, striptease scene that she has, which I feel like people might mistakenly, like, think that, oh, she's a model and she's been in her underwear on stages, so, like, why would she feel weird about it? But she was like, it's just different when, like, all eyes are just specifically on you and you're doing this intimate act. And also she was like more displaying clothes as opposed to like taking them off, you know, in her modeling career. And she said that she actually like took a shot before of tequila, I think, before she did that scene, which kind of reminded me of like Jane Fonda having to do that for Barbarella. Mm-hmm. But in Barbarella, she did it because she was like really, really uncomfortable and in a bad place. With Rebecca Romijn, I think she was just like, I just need to get hyped up for this, because she talks about this film like positively and that she had a positive relationship with Brian De Palma. Like, that's my impression.
Women do not complain about him. Like, no. We should say that. Like, he's worked with some brilliant women who have not come out to say he's abusive or awful or like, has not happened. And he's the director you would assume that would happen with. And it historically hasn't. I would need more than one shot of tequila to pull off. They give me the whole bottle would be this. Yeah, there's no way. I don't know how one shot of tequila equals that, because that strip tease scene is pretty fantastic. But That's impressive.
Well, let's get into De Palma himself. Yeah. So when he started out with his career trajectory, because even now I don't feel like the film bros hold him up in the same way that they hold up like Scorsese or even Coppola to a certain extent. And I'm really curious about this because it seems like he has exactly the same film trajectory of them. And then he hits like the early 90s, 2000s, and I think this is to be praised. He gets into this like one for them, one for me sort of thing after Bonfire of the Vanities in 1990, which was like a complete disaster. But then directly after that, he does Raising Kane. Then he goes to Carlito's Way. Then he goes to Mission Impossible. Then Snake Eyes. Then Mission to Mars. Then Femme Fatale. Then Black Dahlia. Like, it is very much this like, okay, I'm going to do the big budget one, and then I'm going to do it like a small, really deeply weird movie. Like to go from Mission Impossible to Snake Eyes, which is real weird, to Mission to Mars, and then this is like, I think that's very one for you, one for me.
Maybe. I don't think he does one for them. Like, maybe the only example is Mission Impossible. If you watch Mission Impossible, it's excellent, yeah. Solid, but it has all the De Palma markings there. I don't know.
This movie, we should also say, has a bunch of Mission Impossible. There's lots of climbing through tubes.
Oh my God.
Grappling.
Lasers. Yeah. And like, but if you think about it, like, there's no way Black Dahlia is one for them, right? Like, mm-hmm. If this is one for him, 2002, Black Dahlia is one for them, no way.
Interesting.
No way.
What do you think, Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think Alicia's right. Like, all of his movies are mainly for him. Raising Kane, I love that movie.
That movie's awesome.
I love John Lithgow, and I love when he gets to just go like balls to the walls. Like, he's just incredible. But I just kind of actually want to go back to what you were saying, Becky, about like him not being like as beloved by film bros. I do think there is that. Like, there was that documentary made by, I think, Noah Baumbach, Jake Paltrow, that was about De Palma. So like, I think there is a reference, but actually, and I think this is interesting in context for this film, like, I think a lot of women love De Palma. Like, I always have. And I talk to a lot of women, like, mm-hmm. One of our coworkers, Lacey, who's a programmer of our After Hours stunt at Hollywood Suite, she loves De Palma. And we have joked about starting a podcast called De Palmcast, which is just us talking all of De Palma's films. Because, yeah, like, women are naked and it may be, like, it seems exploitive, but, like, I am so interested in those characters and I'm so drawn to them. Like, even someone like Michelle Pfeiffer's Elvira in Scarface, like, she is so iconic too. And, like, is it problematic? Mm-hmm. Yes, but, like, it's also stunning and stylish. Like, I don't know. There's something that draws me.
The men who treat these women badly have horrible fates.
That's true.
You know, I think, I do think De Palma has got film bro written all over him. Like, that's just, I think that's just a fact. But I really love your point, Emily, because you're right. I don't have the same conversations with, you know, women film critics that about Scorsese that I do about De Palma. There is something else there that doesn't feel as alienating, which is shocking given the subject matter of most of his films. Whereas sometimes with Scorsese, not to call it Scorsese specifically, but I mean, listen to our New York episode if you want to know what I'm talking about. Really, really can be hurtful and, you know, difficult to work your head around. Whereas De Palma, yeah, I have no issues with De Palma's at all, which is crazy. Like, you know, and if you watch his earliest films, I think in some ways, like High Mom or the ones with De Niro, and there's a great box set out there with De Palma, De Niro films that just came out. They are brilliant. They're as brilliant as Scorsese's earliest films. In fact, he was the one, if you watch the documentary, he was the one that, like, these guys, Scorsese and Schrader, all, like, just thought he was the best of them. Like, they were so jealous of what he was able to accomplish before they were.
Yeah, he's made some incredible movies. Like, Carrie is my favorite. I love it so much. And that is such a female story. And other women have tried to tell that story and haven't done it as well as I think that he did. So I think, like, he was weirdly tapped in to women in a way that people didn't want to give him credit for. And also just, I always say, I remember telling this to Lizzie Borden, of all people, and she's like, I'd never heard this. And I was like, what? You're Lizzie Borden. But she was like, I was like, you know, I love horror movies. And she was like, I don't get that. Like, I don't get why you would like that as a woman. Like, women are attacked so often in these movies. And Brian De Palma doesn't just do horror movies, but he's done a lot of, like, horror or thrillery kind of films. where women are in peril. And I think, like, for me, it's like cathartic to see women like fighting back or having a chance to fight back against men or other forces of evil. Like, I think that's empowering. And I think that, like, I don't know if he got that or was intending that, but that's sometimes what I get from these films. Like, I love Body Double and I love Melanie Griffith in that film. I think she's just, like, so freaking cool in the same way that I think Rebecca Romijn is really, really, really cool in Femme Fatale.
Mm.
Also, can we just take a second to talk about, there's, like, a queerness to this film that I think is really cool. At the end of the day, spoiler alert, like, it's a love story between two women, a secret love story between two women. And I kind of love that.
And the lesbians don't die. Well, in one version they do, but in version two they don't. But we've also talked about here in 2002, there is so much queer coding going on in like a post world where we've already had new queer cinema, et cetera, but we're watching a ton of movies with queer coding within them. As opposed to people actually coming out.
And I mean, like, I think I watched this for the first time at Brendan's screening of Femme Fatale this past year. And I had been kind of avoiding this because and if I'd seen it at the time, I probably would have been like thinking that it was like queer baiting. Like it was just like, oh, like, and more for the male gaze. But like, now watching it, I was like, oh, this is like cool that this like exists in this. And it's like, yes, we get this like really sexy scene off the top, but like we should have sexy scenes of women together. Like why not? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's complicated. There's a fine line because it is a male director doing this, but are we just not supposed to feature scenes of women making out in the bathroom being really sexy? I don't know.
I mean, obviously, it's very, very difficult. But I think the fact that all three of us are like, it's freaking hot. And I am a woman who does consider myself more on the straight side of the spectrum. But it's also one of those things, like, he's clearly with that, like, million-dollar bra thing in the breastplate and all that. He's taking it from more than likely, because this was very much in the news the year before and whatnot, Victoria's Secret had just started their fantasy bra line, where the big highlight was one of the biggest Victoria's Angels. So Heidi Klum did it three times. Tyra Banks did it twice. Adriana Lima did it. They would wear these like extremely extravagant, bedecked, jeweled bras. The one Heidi Klum wore, I think the first year was $10 million. And what's always been so fascinating to me about that kind of marketing is that it's for men to buy for women, but women are supposed to look at that and go, this is what men think is sexy. So I think there's layers of that going on. And the fact that you have, oh, I mean, there's so much going on here. There's a woman who is basically just like a front piece for these jewels. It's not about the woman actually wearing it. It's about the jewels themselves. Same thing with like a $10 million bra. Like, there's just such an interesting conceptual idea of there of like, Who is this woman? Why is she making out with this woman? What you know? How do they know she has these gems? Like, there's a lot happening here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this idea that men buy the bras for women, I don't subscribe to that at all. Like, maybe some men bought women's bras, but the whole thing with Victoria's Secret and like the brand is that, you know, you could go and purchase these things for yourself. Basically, they were affordable. You know, mostly women are buying lingerie. It's not men buying lingerie. And for me, Ree Rasmussen wearing this piece, I think it's actually really elegant. And, you know, it's a important plot part because you have security. Like, she's monitored everywhere she walks because she's wearing a $10 million worth of jewels. If she goes to the bathroom, she has to ask for permission. They are like outside with guns, like waiting for her because her worth is entirely her adornment. And I think that that is really interesting in a femme fatale, you know, kind of conversation.
All right. Well, I think that is the perfect place for us to transform into our next film because it's about a woman learning her worth. We're looking at Secretary, and that's coming up after the break. Cam, you know one of the reasons why I love working for Hollywood Suite?
The money?
The money. The money is obviously number one because I have a very tiny dog who likes very fancy things.
Sure.
And that costs some cash, let me tell you. I think the biggest thing is that I just love how much care and attention is put into the curation of what goes onto the channel. You and the other programmers do such a great job of finding a huge variety of content that a lot of people haven't seen before, as well as, you know, the classic blockbuster favorites.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the funny thing is you start this job and you you think like, well, what does it matter that somebody gets to see The Warriors or something, Escape from New York, these big movies. But then when you look at the landscape of cable movies and streaming movies, just so many of these classics get lost, even the big boys. And like, forget about, discovering black directors of the 1970s, trying to put a lot of women directors forward. There's all this kind of wealth of material that has yet to come out. And it's always very satisfying when we can get something on the air that we are surprised connects with people.
Yeah, I found a bunch of movies and original series and exclusive series that I've connected with, and I know our listeners are going to as well. You can subscribe to Hollywood Suite through your TV provider, or you can go to Amazon Prime Channels and you can subscribe through that. That's what I do. And if you want to find out more and have a look at listings, you can check out hollywoodsuite.ca. Okay, let's get back to the show. I don't know about you, but when I watch a movie I saw as a young person and loved, found formative even, but you haven't seen it in over a decade, putting it on again can be daunting. What if it's not good? What if it explains partially why you are who you are and how you see the world in a bad way? Well, that's how I felt revisiting the controversial 2002 kinky comedy, Secretary, starring two of my laminated top five stars, James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal. It was the original film to introduce the world to a domineering Mr. Grey. Coincidence? Let's get into it. Emily, had you seen this one before?
You know what? Shockingly, no. And
me neither.
Really?
First time.
Really? Oh, see that? This, I feel like this is one you would have like seen very, very early, Alicia. Interesting.
Probably best that I didn't.
That's kind of how I feel. I like this felt like because it's 2002, so I was like 13. So like this seemed like the height of like scandalousness. Like the poster, as everybody remembers it, the original poster anyways, because I know it's been redone to look a little more 50 Shades. But the original poster is literally like a woman's backside in stockings. And I believe her hands are bound at the bottom. And I was like, whoa, what is this movie? And I came into watching it for this. I was like, man, this movie's gonna be really sexy. I'm like gearing myself up for it. I'm like, I don't know. And surprisingly, it's really more romantic than I ever anticipated. And like the sex acts are actually quite minimal. It's more about the story of this woman sort of finding herself and finding out a way to sort of deal with some of her personal and mental issues through this relationship, which is very complicated. This movie is very complicated, we'll say right off the top, is like, I don't know if it is representing a subculture accurately. I don't know if it would be triggering to people. What do you guys think about this film and it's sort of its meaning? Also, do you want me to summarize it before we get there?
Yes, let's give people a brief summary. And we'll also give a couple of trigger warnings as well, just off the top. This is, of course, dealing with BDSM. Mm-hmm. There is power play happening here. There's also self-harm happening here. And the self-harm is quite graphic and not necessarily well handled. So we will be getting into that just ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So this movie is about this young woman named Lee, who's played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who we see her at the beginning of the film. She exits a hospital where she's been staying for issues of self-harm. And she leaves the hospital and she's like, I kind of could have stayed there forever. Like, I really liked the routine of it all. And then she comes back to her house, which is very chaotic. She has this very little girl bedroom that she lives in. I feel like she feels very infantilized at home. And she eventually is like, in an effort to sort of like step out of the home, she gets a job as a secretary for this guy named Edward Grey, the original Mr. Grey. And they start to have a relationship where he, spanks her if she types something wrong, or she stops self-harming and she starts to engage in these acts of BDSM with Mr. Grey. And it becomes complicated, lines are blurred, but she, in the film, she sort of finds empowerment and love through this relationship.
That's really the best way to put it. Alicia, what did you think about coming to this, and why would you not have wanted to have seen this one earlier?
I think it's just for safety, probably more than anything else. I wasn't 13. I would have been 18. So, you know, probably actually a really good age to have watched this film, but it would have exposed me to things that my 18-year-old high school self would not have really known about or understood so well. I don't know. Like, I really, really enjoyed this film. It's not what I expected it to be, like Emily. I was surprised by how funny it was. I was surprised by how sad I was by a lot that's in this film. I don't know how this would hold up today, to be honest. I do know, and I think it's got major issues. But I would recommend this film, mostly because of how thoughtful and bold the performance from Maggie Gyllenhaal is, who I am a huge, huge fan of, and has gone on to do a lot of really great work, not just as a performer, but through producing and through extremely feminist like activities in her career. I'm thinking about something like The Nick, for instance. Like, this is a great double bill, her character from The Nick and this character Lee in Secretary. James Spader, though, like, what was he doing in the like mid-90s to this period? Like, really setting himself out there as a bit of a pervert. If you think about, you know, Crash, obviously.
Crash, yeah.
96. I always knew him as, like, the Seinfeld guy who gets into the rum raisin, like the recovering alcoholic
who works at
Baskin-Robbins and eats all the rum raisin. Like,
there's a really interesting Charlie Rose interview that's actually about this film, trigger warning for Charlie Rose. But he actually talks about how people kept sending him the script and he kept saying no because he was being offered higher paying jobs. And he is an actor, which I was like, oh, that's actually really interesting considering how many unusual roles you take on, and very creepy, very villainous, and like wild indie movies like Crash, how much of his career really is based upon how am I going to pay my mortgage, right? Like, he's like, I do my best to hold out for roles that like I really believe in. But if it's like, if one's going to pay me more than the other one, I'm not going to do that one for the artistic value. I'm going to go for the paycheck, which I was like, that does not seem like a James Spader kind of thought to me.
Why one would say that in an interview, it's a really bad move.
You don't know?
But also, I don't know if I believe it, like, to be honest.
He feels like a guy who cares about the substance of films. Like, I mean, that's the impression that I get from him. Listen, nowadays he is, like, doing stuff like The Blacklist, so I guess
Ted Danson did CSI, right? Like, it's just sometimes you gotta have the extra home on Martha's Vineyard. I get it. I am not begrudging anyone.
Ted Danson did CSI?
Yeah.
Well, also, like,
did you not know that?
No. Which CSI is that?
He took over for William Peterson. When William Peterson retired, he took
Ted
over for him.
Ted Danson.
I can't believe this new information for you.
But I think James Spader has the trifecta of like sexy perv films, which is Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Crash, and this. Not saying he hasn't done other sexy films, but these all feel connected to me in a like almost like in a progression way where it's like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he's like, he likes to watch. In Crash, he gets into it. And then in Secretary, he's like, okay, I'm finding my partner to live this life with, you know? But he said in that, I watched that Charlie Rose interview, and he was like saying that what he liked about the script and what kind of drew him in eventually was that there was a juxtaposition between the sex and the love story. And I can see why that would attract him, because it's not looking at sex. And I don't think he likes to be in movies that don't look at sex in a complicated way and look at it as a spectrum and look at it as something that everybody processes differently. Because that's what to me Crash is about. It's just like, well, these guys, this is how they get off and this is it, you know?
I really like that Charlie Rose interview because it also brings up an important thing that we're very much missing in movies now is there's no sex in movies. There is chase kissing. There is occasional, like, you know, longing glances. But, like, people don't have sex in movies really that often anymore. And when you start to take that out, you're missing an entire facet of human experience. And not every movie needs sex, but like adult relationships, that's kind of part of what you're moving towards, unless they're, you know, one of your partners is asexual. Like, it's extremely important part of human experience that we're just kind of missing in film now, that I think this film is showing a really interesting aspect of.
I hadn't thought of that. There's no sex in movies right now?
Very, very minimal from what I've seen. Sometimes I'm like, more fucking, please. You don't think so?
I think it just depends what kind of movies you're talking about. Like, yeah, sure. I guess if you go to Cineplex right now, it's mostly Marvel kids movies. So yeah, those don't have sex. But like the average, if any year at TIFF, like I don't think there's less sex in those films. But maybe you're right. I don't know. I've never noticed that myself.
I think it's more like the big mainstream titles don't have it. Like yeah. we're yeah. not seeing Fair. Like a Basic Instinct these days, you know, like I would love to, but we're not seeing that kind of mm-hmm. stuff that's coming to the major Cineplex. Like we're seeing it, of course, because we like to engage with stuff that's not just the mainstream. But I think like even like hearing that audiences would walk out of Babylon because of the opening bit, which like to mm-hmm. me, like, yeah, it's excessive, but it's really not that crazy. Like it's fine. But people couldn't handle that. They weren't ready for that. In their Cineplex.
Yeah, that's a great example, Emily. And that's a huge budget movie from Universal. No, Paramount. Sorry, correction, Paramount. With huge, huge stars. Like, and yeah, the sex, which is very explicit, but also very tame. Yeah, I think it's a good point that we aren't doing rated R, or it's rated R for different reasons than sex. But we still have, like, people like Nicholas Winding Refn, and we still have these kind of enfant terribles. They're just not—they're making films for streaming now. That's the issue, yeah. is maybe the multiplex isn't getting the same level of, you know, TNA that, like, we can just tap into at any time of day on our, you know, streaming services.
Yeah. They were actually expecting a massive backlash to this movie. They were waiting for, like, the bannings. They were waiting for, like, you know, the Catholic Church to come out about it. They were waiting for everything. That never happened. But what they did watch happen at the exact same time was the massive uproar about Solaris and George Clooney's ass in that movie. And the fact that he is exposing his behind. And that they slapped it with an R rating because you see his butt. Like, it's just wild. So it was a weird, I mean, maybe this is just too small for people to really pay attention to. Maybe that was the case. But yeah, just to kind of compare, this is the same year as this. And it was when I went back and was like reading articles, I was like, I did not realize what a big deal George Clooney's butt in Solaris was.
I had no memory of that. I saw Solaris in theaters. I don't even remember his butt. That's how unmemorable it was. yeah, this is just cyclical. This like crackdown on nudity, crackdown on sexuality. It happens perennially, I don't know, every 20 years. We're probably there again. It'll go away. It'll come back. It'll go away. It'll come back. It kind of follows a recession. Like, I don't know. That's just 120 years of Hollywood history, pretty much.
I like that you bring up Maggie Gyllenhaal and her feminist leanings, et cetera. And she's very young in this film. Like this, she's just coming off of Donnie Darko at this point. I believe she would be considered like Jake Gyllenhaal's sister as opposed to Maggie Gyllenhaal in her own right. And one of the reasons this movie, I think, holds up as well as it does is that she was very active in the involvement of the development of her character from the original script. And I think it speaks to Steven Shainberg, who directed this film and talked to her a lot about what she was comfortable doing. It sounds like it was a very safe set. And there's modern interviews where she says she's looking back where she was advocating for certain moments happening that when she looks back on it now, she's like, oh, I understand why I was advocating for that. So for example, in the spanking scene, there at the very end of it happening, she takes her pinky and she puts it over top of his pinky. Mm-hmm. And she says, that's consent. Right? That's saying, I approve of what you've done. We are on the same page here and we want the same thing. And she's like, I didn't realize that was consent until I watched it later on and went, oh, that's why I did that, because that was saying it's okay. So that is interesting to me. Is the fact that he does it without the prior consent is the big issue, but then that's what, you know, launches them on their journey.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the pinky thing because I was reading, like, this movie is based on a short story by Mary Gateskill. Is that how you say it? Mary Gateskill?
Yeah, Mary Gateskill.
And which is called Secretary. And Mary actually wrote, like, a sequel short story called Minority Report, which follows up on the character that I think is named Debbie in the story, but is Lee here.
Yeah.
And in that follow-up, like, Debbie's, like, 50 years old, and the climax of the story is, like Debbie and her Mr. Gray meeting again, and he brings up the fact that being, like, do you remember that our pinkies were touching and that you put your pinky on mine? And, like, basically asking her to be, like, I want you to say that, like, you consented to all of this.
It was
and
okay.
This was okay. And so it's complicated in the sense that, like, when I read that story, I was like, I don't like this guy trying to make this a consent thing when, like, clearly in the short story, it is more of a problematic relationship and she leaves, right? Like, she doesn't, it's not a happy ending. And that's why Mary was kind of, like, upset with the film initially, because she was like, I feel like it kind of, like, changed the intention of what she was doing.
Yeah.
And I just think that there's a lot of blurry lines when it comes to consent, because, like, a woman can say yes and then want to say no later. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, mm-hmm. And it would, in a actual, like, BDSM relationship, there has to be a lot of, like, communication and, like, rules set out. And that they don't really show that. And maybe they did have rules, but, like, we don't see that on screen.
I think the implication that they're making is that they are making the rules up as they go, but it's the fact that they never actually sit down and have a conversation. But of course, that's not good cinema, right? Like, that's part of the issue, is like the didactic element of it, unless, you know, you make that like a sexy plaything as well, right?
I did find, having watched this for the first time, that aspects of the rom-com tied up with a bow ending did not work for me.
Yeah.
You know, she ends up staying at his desk for 3 days. She, like, her family's trying to convince her to, you know, they think it's like she's starving herself because she got fired or something. Like, they don't understand what's happening. They're all trying to talk to her. And, like, James Spader's ex-wife even, like, talks to her. Like, it just, that didn't work for me. Like, I felt,
yeah,
because the short story it's based on didn't end that way, they really just tried to put on, like, almost a PG ending. And I loved everything up until, like, the last 10 minutes, although I do really appreciate that this kind of ended nicely, because it's sort of the whole point of the film.
At the end of the day, do we feel like this is a story that, like, it seems like they intended to, of someone who is learning how to ask for what they want, like, to get their own autonomy, to find who they are and then find someone to be with them in that way.
Yeah, I guess where I get concerned is with the healing aspect. And in some ways, because it's very important to note that, you know, he catches her self-harming at her desk. He notices it and he makes her basically swear she's never going to do it again. And then decides that he's going to, you know, help her by, like, letting her get out that pent-up energy through more sex acts than actual, like, you know, slicing open her thighs or burning herself, which we've seen really graphically depicted on screen prior to that. And it works. Like, she throws her box of knives over the bridge into the river, and she stands up for herself against her mom, who's been driving her to work, and she insists that she's going to walk home, and she starts dressing differently. There, I get a little concerned with this, like, and it's what she needs and wants, is she's a father who is, you know, really destructive, and she's seen him hit her mom, and he's drinking and puts himself in the hospital. Like, she needs a father figure, which is so much of the authority part of this BDSM relationship that they have. And it's not just, what's so interesting about this is it's not just the sex acts, which are very chaste, like Emily says. He, like, will give her permission on what she can eat at the family dinner, and it's things like 4 peas, a tiny scoop of cream potatoes with a pat of butter. Like, he's, and that's very accurate to what also part of this lifestyle is that kind of control and permission and overlord sort of aspect.
He also tells her she can have as much ice cream as she wants. And he does it with a little smirk.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. I mean, that's yeah, the tongue in cheek of that. Cause who wants to eat a scoop of peas anyway? You want ice cream. Yeah, it's that reward, like, you know, kind of restriction and reward, withholding and reward. So, I mean, I've only had about 18 hours
to sit with this.
Don't want to go, and it's intimidating to go on record about something that's so intimate and important in, you know, kink is a really important aspect of sexuality and subcultures, and it doesn't get discussed enough, and it should be more normalized, and it gets very problematized. And I think this film is really important in some aspects of undoing that. And it kind of ends with them saying, like, we are normal people. We are in a normal marriage. We just happen to also be this. And I think that that is really positive. But it definitely seems like it was directed by someone who has a very specific take on BDSM and kink. Mm-hmm. And it might not be everyone's, or it might not be the current take in 2023.
It's also the issue when you have a dearth of things about this topics, about the subject, right? Like, how many rom-coms have we had? How many BDSM rom-coms have we had, right? Like, and that's always the issue when you are one of the lone voices, is everyone looks to you to be like, well, what do you say about it? Mm-hmm. We should also say that he followed this up with Fur, an Imaginary Portrait of Diane Arbus.
Just great.
Which is great. And that is Nicole Kidman and Robert Downey Jr. And again, weird, unusual sex stuff, attraction to other people, and infidelity, and artistic inspiration through sex. So it's clearly someone who has interesting takes on how to represent this to people, and how sex can drive stories and drive lives and change lives.
He clearly is fascinated, and it makes us fascinated because, like, this movie, I think I'll think about for a long time, and I understand why people are so drawn to it. And I also, like, let's be honest, like, sexuality is complicated and it means different things to different people. And so, like, it's hard to, like, say that this film is, like, fully problematic, because to somebody, it probably is very helpful, you know? And
agreed.
And in a way, like, you're like, yeah, it is cool that he helps her stop self-harming. That is great. But I think, like, for me personally, I'm like, okay, he stops her from self-harming, but he uses that information to his own benefit. And that's what's complicated about it, I think. It's like,
great point.
If she said, hey, I want to stop self-harming, can you help me? That would be kind of different. And I know that she might not get there. I don't know. It's just different. But I will say, I think that this is a more positive portrayal than something like 50 Shades of Grey, which, like, shows a woman that, like, basically doesn't want to get into this and gets into a highly abusive relationship. And that's one of the biggest freaking movies or movie series of all time.
With a protagonist with the same last name. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy is Edward Gray.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I went down a huge Reddit rabbit hole about this movie. Number one, to see, like, how people react to it now. And apparently in the BDSM community, large and general scale, most people approve of this as being appropriately or good representation of what they believe the practice is similar to. So that tends to be the thing. But there are huge compare and contrasts about what people think was utilized in 50 Shades of Grey from this film. And the general consensus seems to be that, yeah, there is definitely some borrowing of elements and thematic elements. And then, of course, you have the reverse, as Emily mentioned, where when 50 Shades of Grey was a massive hit, they completely rebranded this film. They changed the poster so it's way more 50 Shades of Grey. They literally said, meet the original Mr. Grey becomes the tagline. And on top of that, they recut the trailer to be a thriller. They recut it to be, like, sexy and thrillery and dramatic.
They
and
being the distributor, not the director, yeah. Not Maggie Gyllenhaal. No. They being, which would have been most likely Lionsgate, and I could be wrong, but yeah. Isn't Lionsgate also producing 50 Shades of Grey? I'll double check that. But, I mean, that's just, you know, that's just a terror. I'm sure Maggie Gyllenhaal was, like, horrified because she's, I love watching her on talk shows. I always think about her. She went on The View, like, a long time ago. And I can't remember, Elizabeth Hasselblad, is that her
Hasselbeck.
Name?
The,
like, really concerned. Hasselbeck. Yeah, and it was just like, Maggie just said something so subtle to her about, like, not imagining ever fucking a Republican, that it was just like, I remember just laughing. I was watching with my grandmother, and I was just, like, laughing at this. Like, you know, she was forced by a PR agency to go on this terrible show with this terrible woman, and talk about, like, her marriage with this other very noted non-Republican man. And it was just such a great term that she's like, yeah, I don't know about that. I really respect your beliefs. I just can't imagine ever fucking a Republican.
I would just love to see Maggie, like, maybe, like, try to direct this, like, sequel story that Mary Gateskill did. Like, maybe it's not literally because of how the ending is different from the original story. But, like, I would just love to see her, like, engage with this text and this character again in her own way, and see the lens that she puts to it, given the stuff that she's given us in the last little while.
Yeah, I always come back to The Deuce. I think about her character in The Deuce. I think about, and she was pretty active in a lot of writing, and, you know, what she accomplished with that is so incredible as this sort of like doppelganger Barbara Loden character who's, you know, directing, the only woman directing porn. And yeah, she's really kind of took this as her calling card and worked with it throughout her career. I was wrong. 50 Shades of Grey is universal, but Lionsgate definitely did something bad with the trailer for this movie, and they shouldn't have done that because it's perfectly good and does not need to be made into a thriller. I mean, 50 Shades of Grey is probably really boring compared to this movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and also just like the chemistry between these two is just bonkers. Like you can imagine these people having sex. Like I think that's the biggest thing. It's like these are both extremely sexy human beings, unconventionally attractive. Mm-hmm. Like we're not talking about like chemistry and sexy. And I think if you were to do a remake of this, they would get two young, hot whatevers that might not necessarily have the chemistry. And then they try to boost the sex acts. But that's not what this is about. Mm-mm.
No, if you're going to do the remake, you got to get the right people. It's got to be like people we love but aren't known as like sex symbols. So like Paul Dano and like, I'm trying to think of like someone else it could be. Like it would be so good.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think this should be remade. It's a bad idea. Bad idea it's all around. Don't do
perfect
it.
Perfect the way it sits. I think that's exactly where we should leave this episode and leave this season. So I want to thank Emily Gagné for all your hard work this season. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute
thank
pleasure.
Thank you, Becky, for all your work. You're on every single episode of this podcast. So you've done the most work of anybody and we really appreciate it. And it's just been a joy to talk about movies with you guys. Like it's just...
Yeah, well, there will be more talking about movies. And Alicia Fletcher, you are very often seen on Hollywood Suite talking about movies. Thank you once again for joining us for this season.
Thank you. Yeah, I got to do some complex films that I hated and some more complex films that I didn't hate. So that's very exciting.
Well, thank you once again, Alicia Fletcher, Emily Gagné, Cam Maitland, all of the incredible guests we have had this season and for the entire series. As I mentioned last week, this is going to be the very last episode of the A Year in Film podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure being your host. We'll be leaving all of the episodes up for the foreseeable future. So if you want to go back and listen to our back catalog, we have so many amazing episodes, so many amazing guests. I've been your host, Becky Shrimpton, and you've been listening to the A Year in Film podcast. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton. Senior producer is Becky Shrimpton, and co-producers are Alicia Fletcher and Cameron Maitland. And today, featured Emily Gagné and Alicia Fletcher as our guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.